Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. You and Mike are still talking about that full moon business from last week. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Audrey and I are affected by full moon, and it was a full moon eve last Thursday when we did our show, and I hope everything came out all right, but Audrey says those are days she would rather avoid. It affects her about 2 or 3 days. But anyway, thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us up and on the show. And everything's connected perfectly. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, ladies and gentlemen, the network that provides you the Jumble Justice Radio Show, and that's the one that you're listening to right now. I'm your host, Keith Haley. As always, we want to thank Johnny Cash for taking on us that long truck ride across the country. If you hear the whole song, he goes to 90 different cities and states and sings that song from memory, if you ever heard him do that in live. And Mike and Emily, we want to thank you also for being with us tonight. And we have some things for you to do tonight that are a little tricky technically. And I know you'll get us through on these electronic connections that we have to do. The purpose of our show is what it is always. We're trying to discuss news, issues, events, developments in this field of criminal justice that is always difficult, sometimes humorous. We have a couple of examples of that tonight. A couple of things are almost unbelievable, actually. And our show is dedicated to those very energetic, tireless, committed police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. And we would be remiss if we didn't mention to folks to remember in their prayers the families and victims of the 9/11 tragedies in the United States. And tomorrow is the anniversary of that, and I'm sure your day is going to be filled with both memories and dedications and all sorts of things, and a very tragic event. I remember flying to Romania about 4 days after that occurred, and it was really something. In fact, some discouraged us from going, and when we did arrive at the airport in Bucharest, all of our colleagues in the university and those in the criminal justice field on the Romanian side, when we got off the plane in the airport, they all applauded us. They thought it was a real matter of courage that we decided to go ahead and continue with our program over there under those circumstances and didn't delay it temporarily. You're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and what more can I say? This is just absolutely fantastic. The President of the United States has discovered Blog Talk Radio, and so has everyone else. And 3 years ago, I think we're up to 150. 47 shows. Is that right, or is that too low? Mike, did you count them? We'll count them and let people know next week. But we're up to like 147 shows, and they were way down in the hundreds. Maybe we were even under 100 when we started our show 3 years ago. Now there are literally thousands. And what that means to you still is that anybody that wants to, an organization, an entity of any kind, that's legitimate, of course. I don't think you can run a criminal enterprise off of BTR, but I wouldn't be surprised someone would try someday. But anyway, you can broadcast and streaming audio live over the internet to an unlimited number of listeners, and it's absolutely free. So I keep encouraging people, groups, activities, folks I run into. Sometimes they just look at me and sort of squint. They can't believe that this is free. And think of what this would have cost you in 1990, 2000, if you were trying to start a little radio station and broadcast to a lot of people around the world. It would be, the price would be just astronomical. So anyway, you can do that, and these shows are archived almost immediately, and you can download them in MP3 format and keep them, play them, mail them to people, whatever you choose to do. So get your own show. That's what I'd recommend. Tonight's show is going to be a little bit different. I think we've only done one other show per se on oral history. And tonight we're going to specialize on oral history relative to the Pennsylvania State Police. And the Pennsylvania State Police have developed a very attractive website about their own history. And as part of that, they have archived on there. You can go to that site yourself. Just Google Pennsylvania State Police Oral History, and you'll go right to that page. But they have archived on their internet probably about a dozen or more oral history interviews with retired Pennsylvania state troopers, and some of them are video oral histories. I've done a lot of oral histories in my time, one way or the other, or directed many others, but I've never done a video one yet. Looking forward to doing that. But tonight we're going to hear from three, what many people would say, old guys, and they're going to tell you what it was like to be a Pennsylvania state trooper decades and decades ago, and some are very interesting. One of the gentlemen, the first one I'll play, he came, joined the Marines in 1942 and spent 3 years in the Pacific, and comes out and goes to the Pennsylvania State Police, and he goes there because somebody said, well, go down and apply, but he thought he was too small, but he got on anyway and had a marvelous career with the Pennsylvania State Police. So that's what we're going to do tonight. In fact, there's enough involved with this, I might do two shows on it. One of the things I'm starting is a little Ohio Criminal Justice Oral History Association. And any listeners would be interested in joining something like that. We're going to get together and sort of teach the method to folks that don't know how to do it. Not that difficult to learn. It's kind of hard work, but what we're trying to do is archive the oral histories of police, courts, corrections, executives, line-level personnel, chiefs, sheriffs, probation officers, parole officers, whatever, here just in the state of Ohio. No other state has such an organization. And I think it would be interesting to do. I've never had a student or any colleague of mine that ever gone out and done an oral history that didn't thoroughly enjoy it. And, of course, the recipient, I mean, the interviewee, they love it because you're recording their history. And many of the stories and ideas and innovations that they talked about or wanted to do in their careers, those would all be lost had someone not done an oral history. And then I always encourage people to give them an audio, too. And nowadays you can do it with a video. Well, you could have done that a long time ago, actually. But now they have something that their great-great-grandchildren can listen to when they are, in fact, gone. So that's what we'll do tonight. We'll be thinking about oral histories with about three state troopers with the Pennsylvania State Police. You're listening on your computer, obviously, or some on your cell phone. You can call in during our news segment of the show if you'd like and talk about some news. That call-in number is 347-996-5983, 346-996-5983 is our call-in number for comments during the news segment of the show. Mike is saying that we ought to do an oral history on Audrey. That's a very good point. Seems like, well, you don't have, there's not an age limit. That I don't want to, because you can do oral histories around a whole career. You can do them around special events. You can do them around somebody's job, and on and on and on. So there are a lot of things you can do in that regard. But maybe we'll get to Audrey eventually. Well, Audrey, you have a blonde joke for tonight, as usual. Am I correct? Are you set with that joke? Let's go ahead and hear it.
Professor Haley, tonight will be one of our shortest blonde jokes, but I do believe our audience will enjoy it. The blondes in the joke are celebrating a victory. Here it is. A bunch of blondes walk into a restaurant celebrating and chanting 28 days, 28 days, it only took us 28 days. Everyone was wondering what took them 28 days, and why they were celebrating. Finally, when the blondes were about to leave, a waiter goes up and asks, "What took you 28 days? Why are you celebrating?" All the blondes say, "We just finished a puzzle in 28 days, and on the box it said 3 to 6 years.
All right. They were way ahead of schedule. 28 days instead of 3 to 6 years. All right. Thank you very much, Audrey. And ladies and gentlemen, given the state of crime and conditions in the United States, which I almost hate to tell people sometimes, but crime is way down. It stayed way down, and that's still a shock to a lot of people. But I think we commented on that last week on the radio show that the National Crime Victimization Survey put out by the Bureau of Justice Statistics just came out with their report, and their report shows that violent crime stayed the same, and even property crime went down. And I think the FBI, when they come out here next month, beginning of October, with their, maybe it's the 15th, with the informed crime reports, they're predicting that it'll probably be about the same. And the National Crime Victimization Survey, Bureau of Justice Statistics folks said that this is the lowest crime rate we've ever seen in the United States since their records have been kept. And they started the National Crime Victimization Survey in 1973. And the UCRs already said, you know, we've had the lowest in like 40 or 50 years or something. But that's a surprise to a lot of people. I mean, you hear a lot of things about crime on television, and any crime is terrible, of course, and particularly when victims are injured or their lives are taken. But crime is relatively down. But anyway, we're going to play our message to the gangbangers and street criminals in the streets of Ohio and the nation and around the world, should they be listening, about the problems with guns.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
And I just hope the right people hear that message, because we don't want criminals carrying concealed handguns in the state of Ohio. And I'm sure that's who that message is directed to. Let's look at the news tonight. And some of it is interesting. Some of it is comical. Some of it can be sad, depending on your nature this particular evening. But let's start out with some of this news and see what we can say. Would you say, folks, that what do you think, Mike? Do you think a judge ought to be able to tape a defendant's mouth in court because the defendant keeps interrupting? Yes, you can do it. Judge Stephen Belden at the Canton Municipal Court, that's Ohio, said it was the best way to restore order after Harry Brown, 51, kept butting in. I've actually seen people in court do that, but I've never seen their mouth taped. The judge ordered a court official to put duct tape over the robbery suspect's mouth after he kept complaining about his court-appointed lawyer. Brown complained his attorney wasn't prepared for that. No. He said his attorney wasn't prepared for the case, and that angered the judge with his constant interruptions. Says after a warning, the judge told the bailiff to tape Brown's mouth shut. When the tape was finally removed, Brown complained that the judge wasn't being respectful. I suppose he had a perspective on that, that's for sure. The judge ended the hearing and sent the case to the grand jury. So looks like it moved on. Weird. Here's another Columbus, Ohio story in terms of strange crime. The police say that this guy named Stephen Bennett, he's 20 years old, he was one of three people who robbed two women in Columbus, Ohio, and robbed them at gunpoint. They robbed Danielle Martinez Batista and Diana Martinez. the late night robbery. It happened in a car park outside of Ms. Martinez's apartment. That's what the paper says anyway. The three robbers fled with Mr. Batista's wallet and Ms. Martinez's purse. And did I say two women? No, it's one man, one woman, excuse me. And took off with the purse after they were threatened by a neighbor. Can you believe that less than 2 hours later, guess what this guy does? One of the three robbers returns to the apartment to ask Ms. Martinez out for a date. He says, we're not exactly sure what he was thinking at the time, a Columbus police sergeant says. And he says she recognized him right away when he returned and was able to have her cousin call 911. So that's one robbery solved. And I think if they weren't caught at this one, it sounds like these guys aren't going to bust the top off of an IQ test. They were probably caught in the next one. Now, I have a story here tonight about the Austrian police, and I'm going to relate it to a story about the Pittsburgh police. Life is different in countries in many, many, many ways, and in terms of respect being shown for the police, it also varies, and I think these two articles will show that. We have a story here about an Austrian man who was fined £45, British money, it's a British story, for breaking wind, in other words, passing flatulence while he was being questioned by police officers. I'm not kidding. They said this guy, the laughter passersby, humiliated them, and it gave them grounds to book Hansi Sporer, 20, under a local police anti-abuse law. In other words, this guy kept passing gas when people were going by purposefully, the police said, loud flatulence, and everybody laughed while they were standing there trying to question the guy about something. He says this was no accident. He clearly intended to make a laughing stock out of the officers, and he deserved what he got, says one of the police sources. The Safety and Security Act allows police to issue instant fines to anybody who insults or attacks them. Huh. Lawyers for Mr. Spohr argued that his outburst had been accidental. You know, in every crime, there's at least two elements. There's actually about eight or nine, but there's always what they call the actus reus, which is the physical act of the crime. In other words, insult and battery, it would be like swinging your fist and punching somebody in the nose. And then there's always the mens rea, the mental element of the crime that usually has to be proved. In other words, I could swing my fist if I had some type of seizure and hit somebody in the nose and perform the same physical act, but it wouldn't be a crime because I didn't intend to do that person harm. It was an accident. Well, in this case, I guess we're trying to prove whether the flatulence were intentional outbursts or they were done accidentally, so you wouldn't be able to prove the mental element of the crime. Well, how serious can we get? This sounds like one needs to go to the court. But anyway, this is an abuse of a serious law intended to protect police officers from serious attacks by members of the public, not some trivial incident. This is what Mr. Spohr said. He decided it was easier and cheaper to pay the fine than to fight it. Now, think about this one. My date here says that we're okay on this, and it wasn't last week. I don't believe, was it, Mike? I don't think so. But can you, in fact, give a police officer the finger? In other words, the bird. Can you, in fact, do that? Yes, according to the court in Pittsburgh, that's possible. The American Civil Liberties Union and attorneys for Pittsburgh will be in federal court to determine if city police officers are properly trained on First Amendment matters. The ACLU contends Pittsburgh police too often issue citations for people swearing, making obscene gestures, and other acts deemed disrespectful. This case started Tuesday, concerned a Pittsburgh man cited for disorderly conduct for flipping his middle finger. David Hackbird made the gesture at another driver in 2006, then made the gesture again when he heard someone yelling at him, realizing only later the second person was a police officer. The federal court ruled in March that Hackbard shouldn't have been cited because he was engaging in constitutionally protected expression. Jurors will also determine damages for Hackbard. Now, let's run a little experiment here among our listeners. Let's see how valid this is. Let's have each one of you go out and, I'm kidding, give a police officer the finger and see what happens to you. And you can report back either from your jail cell next week or from home. But isn't that incredible that you can actually do that? I mean, I wouldn't advise going out and doing that to a police officer for a whole bunch of reasons. The first of which would be it would be disrespectful, but that's interesting. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit and take a look at the prison system. One of the things that's happened in Virginia right now is that there's a group called Quest Institute, and they've been providing books to prisoners, personal books to them, for them to own, not to put in the library, in a program called Books Behind Bars. They've literally put, I guess, over a million books in cells statewide. They say it's a relatively low-cost way to help inmates who want to learn. And they talk about some here that need help. One guy wants a dictionary. He's working on his high school GED. He says, there's just a lot of words I don't know. Another criminal, he's serving his 18th year. He wanted some Christian fiction and some Stephen King books. And then a 61-year-old woman, she requested a how-to book on crocheting and a book of Bible commentary. Well, Quest Institute, Books Behind Bars, they wanted to provide it. And now what's happened, because they mail these books directly, by the way, to the prisoners. They don't bring them to prison. They mail them, and then they're checked in for contraband as they come in. But guess what? Two or three times something has happened. They're not saying what it was, but there was contraband hidden inside the books. I guess everybody's seen those books that are, you know, carved out a little bit, and somebody carries a gun. Looks like they're carrying maybe the Bible, but they're really carrying a .38 pistol or something like that. I don't know if that was this. Might have been a cell phone. Who knows what it was? And, you know, prisoners are very ingenious when you have a lot of time to think about something. If you've ever seen a table full or a display of contraband and weapons that prisoners have made behind bars, it's really something. I mean, ever seen a knife made from toilet paper? That's why they don't get extra toilet paper. It hurts just like any other kind of knife. But anyway, Virginia's stopping it. They're not going to let Quest do this. They think they don't have enough security officers, enough corrections officers to look for the contraband, and eventually will endanger their the safety. Anyway, Books Behind Bars gets about 500 letters each month from inmates. Churches and other groups donate books, and they donate money. John Grisham has given 100 copies of his books to prison. Doesn't seem like it's a lot, but it's some. It's more than I've given this year to prisoners. But isn't that interesting that prisoners want books, but you know, a very small percentage of people seems like they're going to ruin it for the rest of the folks. The AP has finally picked up on the Lancaster, Pennsylvania story with the surveillance cameras. They have a nice article here. It goes on and on about what's going on in Lancaster, and they look at what's going on in some other cities in the United States and how effective or ineffective primarily these cameras have been. And Wilmington, Delaware, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. They talk about the University of California study, which we've talked about on here, Cambridge, Mass. All these have varying results, but none of them are outstanding in terms of what to do with, in terms of these cameras being worth all the expenditure and deterring crime. Now, guess what? Jenna Napolitano, our Director of Homeland Security, she is recommending that the Girl Scouts join us in the fight to prepare for war, pestilence, and terror. And they want to entice the blue, brown, and green-clad multitudes to be even more prepared with the promise of a new patch if they pitch in. And they're going to go through emergency training. If they do that, undergo this training, complete it, they're going to be able to emblazon their sashes or vests with this new patch. This new preparedness patch will increase citizen preparedness and enhance our county's readiness for man-made or natural disasters, says Janet Napolitano. Be prepared is the Girl Scouts motto. I didn't actually realize that. Same as the Boy Scouts, isn't it? And I can't believe that they're going to be actually doing something relative to the war on terror and all kinds of other things. But they're going to work with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And I didn't realize this. I mean, I was, you know, barely here. But other than making boxes of cookies, which they've done for a long time, During the Second World War, they actually operated bicycle courier services. They invested more than 48,000 hours in farm aid projects. They collected fat and scrap metal, and they grew victory gardens during the Second World War. So that's incredible. Anyway, after the 9/11, this is a nice thing, I think, probably for the Girl Scouts to get involved in, although aren't you supposed to be studying ants and the flowers and the birds and things like that? I hope it doesn't detract from that. Okay, last story. We're going to do a couple green things here and then get to our oral history. Bangladesh has come up with a breakthrough way to save energy, to help us go green. And what they've done is they've banned suits and ties. Yes, I'm not kidding you. They have done it. In addition to eliminate pointless and uncomfortable decorative elements from men's clothing, the move will minimize the need for air conditioning. So they've been running their air conditioning in their government buildings at 75 degrees. So now they're going to not allow men to wear suit jackets. They're not going allow them to wear ties. And they're not going to require them to tuck in their shirt. You know, what's next in this? I mean, there has to be a prognosis of future in terms of this. If you can actually save energy, turn down your air conditioning, or turn it off perhaps, what if you didn't wear any clothes at all? Is that the next step? Will we be able to sacrifice and change our civility attitudes about that if, in fact, we can reduce CO2 into the atmosphere? So, remember where you heard it. It's an interesting thing. By the way, did you know that one of Esme Floyd's tips in her book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, I'll just be real brief about this so we can get to our oral histories, but one of her tips is that if you want to protect the environment out there, why are you washing your windows? Because one of the things you do when you wash your windows, it makes it dangerous for birds. Birds, you know, you've seen birds fly into a plate glass window or a pixel window or something like that in a house. So they're saying if you would stick stuff up on the windows, which I guess would keep, see, how would that work CO2-wise? Okay, yeah, that'd keep it, make it more shady. That would probably work. Or if you don't wash your windows, then the birds will recognize that that's glass and they won't fly into it and endanger themselves. I think that's a great idea. And think of it, if you're not expending the energy of going up and down and around washing windows, then you're reducing your carbon footprint. But somebody's going a step farther. They're saying the real key to climate change, the quintessential move is to have fewer children. So if you get a system here where you're only allowed to have like one child, then we have to have the child police to go around and check, then that will, in fact, they say, really reduce the carbon footprint. This is kind of interesting because they're saying that you can save each child that doesn't come into being will save like one ton of carbon, of CO2, into the atmosphere. I still say the real thing for the greenies to do, the conservationists to do, is to, decide that their time is up. And if they could remove at least part of their carbon footprint, then the rest of us would not have to suffer as much. It says here contraception is almost 5 times cheaper as a means of preventing climate change than conventional green technologies. And this is done by research done by the London School of Economics. And that's not a bad place. They know what they're talking about. Anyway, try to keep track of that CO2 business and make contact with whoever in the sky is running the big calculator to make sure all this is accurate and valid to start with. But anyway, that's what we're doing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about oral history tonight and give you a preview sample of some here from the Pennsylvania State Police. And for those who might not know exactly what the method is, it's a very interesting procedure. If you're talking about somebody's career, which is often the way it's done, an oral history is something where you don't have questions per se. You have 8 or 10 topical areas about the type of field that they work in. If you're interviewing a state prison director, for example, one of my students, Jeff Carson, did an outstanding, in fact, we had him on the show, did an outstanding oral history interview with Bennett Cooper, who was 84 at the time, and he was the first black prison director of a state prison system in the United States. Just a wonderful gentleman, and so was his son, worked with one of my friends in psychological testing of police officers. But you go out and you talk, and you get them to talk, you say, tell me more. You'll hear some of that in the interviews tonight. And then you go back and you transcribe all that out, and then you always see what you missed. So you have to go back for about another hour, and you get all that information. You come back, transcribe it, and then you edit, put the missing pieces in. And then what you have is both an audio and a written transcription of this person's life or career. And it's absolutely fabulous. And the nice thing about it, that oral history subjects like this, because interviewees, because, you know, if they pass on, all these stories are lost usually. They're not documented or recorded any other place. Then if you can give them even an audio tape or now a video, then you have something that their children, great-grandchildren, whatever, can look and see grandma or grandpa or great-grandma or great-grandpa. And it's fun to do. It's a little bit of work to do once you learn the method, but the guy that legitimated this was Studs Terkel. I think I mentioned that when we did the one oral history show with the Minneapolis police officer, or St. Paul police officer in Minnesota. But he legitimated this in the 1970s. He had about two or three books in the 70s, but his big one, he did oral history interviews with over 100 people in a book called Working. It's a fantastic book. It's lying on my desk. I would highly recommend you get it. But he, installment buyers, journalists, cops, prostitutes, on and on and on, and talked to them about his career. And prior to that time, historians didn't like oral histories because history is documents, artifacts, and memory. Well, the historians focused on documents, historical documents, and artifacts. But memory, they said, wasn't really very accurate because people forget. You know, if you're talking to somebody about something 30 years ago, what would they know? But these same people would go look at some document that was 150 years old where somebody was remembering something 30 years prior to that time, and they would consider it as, nearly gospel. So anyway, he popularized oral histories, and it sort of took off, and Studs went on and did a book about all the guys that were actually in the Second World War that went over the sides of the ships and the Pacific and that type of thing. Then his last book was Coming of Age, and he looked at the careers and lives of about 94 people that were all over 70. And I think of that group, by the time the book was done, four of them had already passed. A fantastic book to see the courage and the happiness of these people that still saw life as a challenge and enjoyed every day as they should. So hold on here for a moment, and what we're going to do is take a look at, I think we'll probably play two, possibly three little oral history clips from these Pennsylvania State Police officers talking about their career. And then next week we'll take one of these and the second part of the show we'll sort of hear it in depth, and you'll get an idea about the whole oral history idea. So hold on, and we'll be right with you. Right, the first one I'm going to work here with is a guy named Charles Kovage. And Kovage came on the state police somewhere around 1947, if I'm not mistaken. And we'll take a listen to him first, and we'll stay with him quite as long. He's a little harder to hear than the other two gentlemen, but that'll give us a little variety to hear at least two and perhaps three of these folks that spent their career with the Pennsylvania State Police, which, by the way, was the first state police organization in the United States, and that grew out of the need to have some police protection at coal mine strikes. So here we go with Charles Kovage.
Bob Gerken, and I'm here at State Police Academy. It's September 13, 2005. As retired corporal Charles Kovic. Charlie, I want to thank you for being a part of this very special day. Can you tell me where you were born?
I was born in Popsville, Pennsylvania.
And what is your date of birth?
May the 3rd, 1923.
Okay, so that makes you
an old man. 82 years old.
82 years old. You were born and raised in Pottsville.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you live there for most of your life? How long were you there?
Well, until I joined the Marines.
Okay. And how old were you when you joined the Marines?
17.
Did you complete high school and then join the Marines?
I got my diploma and joined the Marines, yeah.
Remember the year that you joined the Marines?
1942.
And where were you eventually stationed?
I was in the... I went through Parris Island training there and then ended up in the Pacific with the 2nd Marine Division from 1942 to 1945, all the time I was over there at those islands.
And after you were discharged from the Marines, where did you go?
After I discharged, I went back to, first of all, went out to California for a while. Then I come back in the Pottsville, and I worked at Vietnam Steel. And while I was working there, and then they stopped this football team, the Pottsville Maroons. So I played football with them. And then 1946, when I joined the state police. Actually, when I joined the state police, I thought it was too short. And I hesitated about going down there, and because I intended to get married. And I had to... In fact, I said, when I joined the Marines, and my mother said, when I went back to join the state police, and she was telling me, she said, well, why don't you go down and take the examination? I said, Mom, I said, I'm too small. So anyway, going back over the mountain, I had an old broken down Ford. I was coming down, I had to go into Harrisburg, which that was up to 21st and 3rd Street, and up there, I was late getting in because the car broke down going over the Blue Mountain. I had to get down there and come a ride into Harrisburg. And Jake Mock, deputy commissioner, he said, who are you holding up the state police? You know that? He said, you want to be a state police? And I said, well, I said, you want to chase me out of here? I said, I'm just to get out of here and go. No, he said, you're going down to Hershey. So he sent me down the old academy down at Hershey and down Cocoa Avenue. There, Bob. Yeah.
What caused you to join the state?
Well, because I fill out an application. So that's what my mother said. If you don't go down there and take the examination, if you flunk, you know you at least tried. But I was happy enough to get in, though. So I seen no Sergeant Wissinger. Al Wissinger was the first sergeant down the old barracks. And I didn't have any other clothes even to go back up home. I said, how about if I go back up home and come back? He said, you get up them steps, boy. Don't come down to see me. I'll see you, okay? I said, okay, so you run in the south to Duffy. So anyway, I stayed there. And then I finished up training in Philadelphia, out in City Line Avenue, the old place. I don't know if they still have it there. So. And other than that,
was it basically something that you thought about as you were growing up?
Yeah, my brother was a lot bigger than me, and he had an application, and that was always in my mind. And so he was more fit for the state police than me, but I was always a different kind of person. So,
but your brother never did join.
No. No, he went back in the Navy. He retired from the Navy, and that was it.
You said your training initially was on Cocoa Avenue.
Right.
Interestingly, today, the state police is dedicating a historical marker at the old academy.
Oh, that, yeah, I understand that. That's wonderful, because that was really home, I'll tell you. But we had all those horses down there and everything else, and Corporal Huzmar. He was a leading man with the horses, and he kept you going. Corporal Grofnik kept me, he was a corporal at the time, and he kept me down there to work with the dogs, which I did. And I broke in all that way. So, tell me about the training during the academy days. It was familiar, almost as much as today as boxing and different things. You had a defense and all that stuff, and all different. You had your pistol range, and that was in the back, right behind the old place there. But that was all home there, and we had all the dogs on the outside there, and all the horses. And it was a little different than you have today. It's really nice here, beautiful.
How long did you train left?
Let's see. It was about the same thing they have today. And I finished up down in Philadelphia, down in City Lion Avenue there. And then they called me back for the rodeo for trick riding. That's where, because I developed in the horses with trick riding and the motorcycles and all that stuff.
Was the St. Louis Academy your first exposure to horses?
Yes, definitely, yes. But I've seen them from a distance, but I didn't get around them. But we learned to ride them up there.
And I sense that you enjoyed that part of it.
Definitely, yes.
You say you finished up your training on Delamonte Avenue.
Yeah.
Down in Philadelphia. Why did that happen that you knew you were training in Philadelphia?
Well, we had to go back up there for extra training on the highways, you know, and taking out on patrol and everything else. Stopping traffic and different things.
While you were at the Spring Academy, were you being paid at that time?
Well, it was under the government, after the service, after being in the service, and they paid for your training. You got paid out of that. And in those days, you didn't make that much money.
Can you describe to me what a day of training would have been like?
Well, getting up early in the morning, you either do a calisthenics or something else, and then you had to go down and clean all those stables, because there's about 80 horses down there, and you had to clean them and get ready, and you had your classwork and everything else and straighten out, and then you'd work with the place cleaning up. It was very different.
You put in one day.
Yeah.
Then while you were in Philadelphia, did you graduate from the academy before you were called back to the rodeo?
Oh, yeah. We finished our training.
Were you assigned to a station if you were training to
Philadelphia? I was actually supposed to get down to Bethlehem, and Captain Cooper down there was looking for me all the time. So when they kept me for the rodeo, And Major Martin, they kept me there, and actually John Groff, Corporal Grofnik at the time, and became Colonel, and he was a great guy, and he just took a liking to me in some way because of the way I was working with the dogs and everything. And actually the other dogs, and later on in life, we even got bloodhounds. I ran the bloodhounds too, and trained them, and all that stuff.
Like when you graduated from the academy, you came right back. You became involved in the rodeo.
Definitely, yes.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
Well, Bob, actually, I was mixed up with trick riding, with the horses and the motorcycles and all this other stuff, and then working with the dogs, and I had a dead dog act, and I don't know if you remember that. I used to pull them in half and everything else. We'd climb up the ladder and go down the other side, and we'd put them in the cart and drag them off, and the other dogs would drag them back down the other side. It was all comical. And the whole thing, actually, even when I started this bum outfit, you know, I used to change costumes all the time, different
Well, that's a little bit of Mr. Kovich's background. Let's take a listen to someone else. We may pick him up next week, but here's here's another interview of a guy that's very interesting. It's Pete Buchan, if I can find him here on the list pretty quick. And he has some interesting stories to tell, and he has a motorcycle story himself, I think. They did three separate interviews with Pete Buchan.
Interview with Sergeant Keith Buchan on November 16th, 2004, Tape 1. Tell me a little bit about your background.
Well, I was born in Latrobe, September 11th, 1936. I was the ninth child. I have four older brothers and four older sisters. My father was a blacksmith and worked at the Latrobe Steel Company. He had also worked in the coal mine as a blacksmith prior to that. And my mother was a housewife. I lived in Latrobe and attended Latrobe schools. And I graduated Latrobe High School in 1954.
How about a little bit about your professional background, your civilian employment?
When I graduated high school in 1954, I enlisted in the United States Air Force in July 13th of 1954, and I spent 4 years in the Air Force. Part of the time was in the United States, Massachusetts, New Jersey. Then I went to Europe. And I was in Paris for several years. It was in Paris that I took a competitive examination for the United States Air Force Academy. I passed. I was selected. I was sent back to the Naval Academy Prep School at Bainbridge, Maryland, being that the Air Force Academy was new and did not have a prep school of its own. I stayed there from October to February, at which time I resigned. And when I was doing an exit interview, they wanted to know why I resigned, and I said I wanted to go back to Pennsylvania and become a Pennsylvania State Trooper. So from there, I left and went to Bowling Air Force Base again, the base commander, a major general, tried to get me to stay in the service. I was due out in 2 weeks in April, and again, I declined, and I came back home and got a job at a place called Pittsburgh Aluminum Alloys, and I was a aluminum extrusion press operator. And I, well, at that job, I went to the State Police Parish in Greensburg to apply for the state police. The first person I encountered was a Sergeant Schnabel. I'll never forget the name of the man. He was quite raspy and grump. I wanted to know how many teeth I had in my mouth, but he did give me an application, which I submitted. The reason that I wanted to stay police goes way back to when I was a young child. I actually used to travel with my father on Saturdays and Sundays. We used to go on trips or go to see our uncle. And one day I was in the car and we seen a ghost car, which was the old state police white cars with the black hood. And my dad said, "There goes my chicha." Well, chicha in the Serbo-Croatian language is uncle. And I asked my mother, I said, how could that be his uncle? She said, "Well, your father had many dealings with the state police. They have taken many guns off him during strikes." So she says, he calls them all uncle, which is chicha. And they came to the house a couple times when my oldest brother John was involved in motor vehicle accidents to get his statements, etc. And I was in awe when I seen these big men in these gray uniforms. And I was kind of excited about it. I really wanted to be a member of the Pennsylvania State Police. Once I signed the papers, I went back and worked, and I heard in June I got my first notice to take the test. I took the test, and I heard in August that 1958 that I had passed the test, and I would be notified shortly of where to report. They expected to take a class in the week of October 27th of 1958. 160-some people took the test. I came in 37th, and I had to report to 21st and Hearst Street, Troop A1 headquarters in Harrisburg. I reported that morning. My sister and her husband took me down, and we stayed at a motel overnight, and they had my car. So I took the car and drove to 21st and her and went in for my physical examination and my oral interviews. And there was a gentleman in a white shirt and a tie. I had no idea who he was. And when I found out, I passed my physical, and I had my review before a board of three officers, and for love of me, I can't remember their names. I learned that I had passed. This gentleman in the white shirt and tie told me I had passed and that I would have to get on the school bus. And I explained my predicament. I said, I got my sister and her husband at a motel down the road. He got a little bit angry with me, and he said, all right, you get down there and you pick them up and you get back here and you'll follow the school bus out to the State Police Academy in Hershey, or State Police Training School was called then. And it was on Cocoa Avenue. It was the old training center. So I did exactly what he said without still knowing who he was. And I found out, of course, when I got to the training center, his name was Sergeant John I. Grosnick. So we got to the training center. My sister and her husband, they left, and I walked into the training center with the rest of the recruits, and a sergeant yelled at us as soon as we come in, drop your bags and stand up against the wall. With that, the gentleman behind me looked up and said, I'm not about to do this again. He said, I had enough of this in the Marine Corps, and he turned around and walked out the door. The rest of us lined up against the wall, and then they took us in and fed us lunch. And after that, we went through the supply and got our uniforms, which were khaki pants and light blue shirts with state police patch on them, which was the cadet uniform and a tie, and your black shoes and socks. And we were assigned our bunks or our rooms. I was put in a day room, which is on the second floor of the training center, and all the classrooms and the offices were on the first floor. So from then, that's when we started our state police training. That consisted of getting up at 6 in the morning, falling out at 6:15 for calisthenics. At 6:30, we went to the stables to clean up after the horses and to dress up the stalls and dust down the horses and clean. And at 7 o'clock, we were back into the cafeteria, or dining room, I should say, in this case, to eat our breakfast. And at 7:30, we went up, changed our clothes, and we're in the classroom at 8 o'clock. We attended class till 12 noon. Lunch was at 12 sharp. Finished at 12:30, we were back in class at 1 o'clock. And we attended class until 5 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, we had our supper. And at 6 o'clock, we had class again till 8 o'clock. It was either boxing, jiu-jitsu, in the gym. And then 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock was your study time. 10 o'clock was lights out. You got to go home every other week if your grades were good. And you got to go out Wednesday evening from 6 to, I believe, 8 o'clock to get your laundry done at the various laundromats. The subject that we taught was criminal law. We were taught the vehicle code, Pennsylvania geography, everything pertaining to what the state police would do in regard to search and seizure and anything to help you become a trooper and know the various laws and conduct what is expected of us as far as our conduct, how to conduct ourselves. It was interesting. It was lengthy. We also took care of the horses. We rode them and learned how to ride them approximately, I believe we were out there 3 days a week. We cleaned them. We groomed them. We rode them. First, we rode them with the saddles. Then we rode them without the saddles. We rode them backwards. And it was all a matter of training us to be the state troopers that they wanted us to be. They also had motorcycles. We had dogs, German shepherds. We had a donkey.
What was the donkey for?
Well, he took us there a long time, and they used him when they did the rodeo shows. And there was a crew that they used him, and we had a horse by the name of Dan. They also used him. I can remember that quite vividly. It was interesting. When we left the academy to go home, we got out after an inspection at 12 o'clock noon on a Saturday, and we had to be back by midnight on Sunday night. Now, if you had an inspection, you had to pass the inspection, which means everything had to be spick and span and clean. And when the corporal or sergeants came around and inspected it, they found some dirt, and then you had to reclean, and then they'd wait a half an hour, 45 minutes before they would come back. And that happened several times. That's where we got stuck.
Okay, I think you begin to get the idea of, if you're unfamiliar with it, what the oral history method is like. And then these two subjects, these two state troopers are good examples in the contrast that you might find in interview subjects. The second one, Pete Buchan, very talkative. You see very little interruption by or prodding by the interviewer herself, because he talks a lot. And the other one, the guy, I don't think it's just a matter of age, but he needs a little more prompting, and he just sort of answers the questions directly. So if you're looking for a subject to really enjoy for a first oral history interview, one of the things to do is to get somebody that's really very talkative. And that's your best type, because you can always, it's easier to edit out than to keep going back and having to get, you know, enough content from someone that's not as descriptive, perhaps, and reflective as they should be. And reflection's a big part of oral history. Get them to reflect on these experiences and what these experiences meant to them in their lives. But I suppose people didn't realize how big horses were in the history of the Pennsylvania State Police, but I didn't know anything about this rodeo and all this business, and I'm curious about that. I'll be listening to the other interviews. Apparently everybody learned how to clean the horse stalls when they were at the at the academy. So very interesting. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed the show tonight, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week. And I think we're going to do a double back-to-back on this Pennsylvania State Police. And next week, I think we'll hear some of these have three interviews with them. In the meantime, if you have time, go look at that site yourself and see what's going on there. Right, we have a caller. I'm going to take a call real quick. Hello? Hello? Well, that caller's gone. I'm sorry. I didn't see it, but I had my switchboard minimized there while we were listening to the oral history interviews. But we'll see you again next week, and we'll do something on the Pennsylvania State Police and probably listen to a long series of interviews of one of these very interesting state troopers. Good night.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So